Funding for Think comes from SMU Continuing and Professional Education.
You're listening to Think on KERA 90.1. I'm Chris Boyd. Does the word dictionary mean something different to you than it did to your grandparents? More than 170 years after its founding, Merriam-Webster is America's last fully staffed dictionary company. Its employees are currently working on the most extensive overhaul since the release of Webster's third new international dictionary, Unabridged, way back in 1961. Along with adding new words and updating the definitions of old ones, dictionary authors and editors are deciding what a dictionary should be in the 21st century. Now that digital technology has revolutionized the way most of us search for information about words and liberated publishers from the space limitations of hard copy. Stefan Fatsis joins us to talk about all this. He's a commentator for All Things Considered and a frequent contributor to Slate, where his article, The Definition of a Dictionary, is online now. Stefan, welcome back to Think.
Thanks, Chris.
The offices of Merriam-Webster sound incredibly quaint. Tell us a little bit about the place.
It is an anachronism. I mean, this is the Merriam-Webster is housed in a building that was finished in 1940, and it hasn't changed very much since then. There's still these big old oak desks. There were cubicles added in the 1990s, but it looks like they were added 20 years ago. The paint on the walls is sort of hospital green and cafeteria yellow. It doesn't look very high tech, which is what we expect from publishers these days.
And a lot of their inventory, like this precious stash of words and definitions and information, it lives on 3x5 index cards.
It's fascinating. There are rows of brick red metal filing cabinets on the second floor, which is the editorial floor of this building. And in them are more than 16 million slips of paper, 3x5 slips of paper. There was an elaborate system that Merriam used for decades to track and mark and follow the progress of words and the definitions that Merriam editors wrote of these words. So they are stuffed in there, and you know, open up any one and you can pull out a stack and you can sort of see what the editors wrote in 1930 or 1950. There would be pictures pasted to these slips of paper, a definition in progress, clippings from newspapers and magazines. It's a wonderful sort of trip through our lexical history, and really the history of the English language, the American English language. I mean, this is it. This was a repository of American lexicography and American language. It's a fun, fun place and fun, fun thing to see. Of course, they don't use the paper anymore. Mm-hmm. I mean, they've moved to an electronic filing system more than about 20 years ago. But they kept printing out the slips of paper until about 5 or 6 years ago, and now everything's electronic.
How has Merriam-Webster managed to hang on to full production capacity when most other dictionary producers in the U.S. today are basically like sideline operations?
And they really are. Most dictionary companies, American Heritage, Random House, there are probably four staffers at most of these places. Max, American Heritage, I think, has four full-time lexicographers. The Oxford English Dictionary has a huge staff in England and four or five lexicographers in New York. Merriam has an editorial staff of 40, and they're actually adding to it because of the project that you mentioned in the intro. And the way they've managed to hang on is sort of twofold. One is reputation. I mean, their collegiate dictionary was a huge bestseller for many, many years, over a million copies for many years. They have a big backlist of smaller dictionaries, specialized dictionaries, a learner's dictionary for English as a second language. So there's still a market for books. But what's changed for Merriam and what's allowed them to progress and stay in business and thrive is the internet. They threw up the collegiate dictionary online a long time ago, and they get now more than 100 million page views to that website, which is free and based on the college dictionary, the collegiate. There also is a separate website for the unabridged dictionary. And that's subscription only, $30 a year. So between the subscriptions, which aren't a huge number, but it's something, plus the advertising on the free site and the mobile sites that they have, they're now making more money from digital sources than from selling print books. The president of Merriam, John Moore, said to me, "We are primarily a digital publisher. Those lines have crossed, and they're not crossing back."
What's remarkable about all of the online presence is that they can have a really clear sense of the kinds of words that people are looking up.
It's one of the great tricks of dictionary publishing in modern times. And Merriam has done a nice job of sort of exploiting that. Every time you go onto Merriam's website, it tracks what you look up. And they will now, they publish, and they've been doing this for a few years, they have a sort of a top 25 list on the website, words that have been looked up the most in the last 24 hours, the last week, and all time. And what that allows them to do is two things. One is to sort of generate news off of what we're looking up. So I'm sure if you went on Merriam's website right now, and I will do that in a second, you will see a word that someone used last night in the State of the Union address, and it spiked. More people started to look it up on their free lookup. And there might be, you know, other words that were related to the State of the Union that have cracked the top 10. And then Merriam's lexicographers, Peter Sokolowski, Emily Brewster, Corey Stamper, they're sort of young, they're hip, they're attuned to the digital age. They have big Twitter followings. They've sort of got this little nerd cult following online. And they will tweet out, you know, this word is spiking online. President Obama used it in a speech last night. So it allows them to tailor their sort of PR operation to generate more interest in the dictionary. But at the same time, what it's allowed them to do is figure out what words need to be revised now. What are the most important words? What are the words that the public looks up the most? And once you can figure that, once you know that, then you can tailor how you proceed with your revisions of the dictionary. So if you know that, for instance, pragmatic is the most looked up word since 2010 when Merriam started putting these lists online, you know that that should be a priority in terms of what you update, because a lot of people are going to go look it up. And that's what Merriam's done. They assigned the top words as part of their update immediately, and they're sort of plowing through the top 1,000 most looked up words and hope to get those done by the end of the year.
How does everybody on the team get assigned to the words that they will revise and redefine and just sort of keep current?
In some cases, it's specialties. So some definers have graduate degrees in something, and they will be assigned to work on that. For instance, there was when I was visiting, there was a guy on staff that has an expertise in music. So he's not a full-time definer. He's more of an editor. But because he's into music and knows a lot about it, he was assigned basically, go ahead and revise as many music terms as you can. Another definer has been working on religious terms for the last 3 years, on and off. It's not quite as codified, though. Editors will mix up the assignments so definers get to work on different things so they don't get kind of bored, really. So right now you might be assigned to work on the new words list, which is really fun because they're new words and nobody's written definitions for them before at Merriam. But then you might get switched over and are assigned to work on a particular letter or a particular subject area or words that really need revising, like those most looked up words. So it really the editors try to mix up the assignments to keep everyone sort of fresh.
I love the idea of it being someone's job to write the dictionary, and they all take this work very seriously. They seem to approach it with a kind of reverence, regardless of the word and how ridiculous it might sound.
Oh, and I think that's there's that distance, that critical distance that you need to have to do this. I mean, it is an incredibly monastic place. These are mostly graduate students or failed graduate students or people with advanced degrees that just didn't want to go into academics and love words. There's a lot of masters in linguistics or masters in literature or English language. And this is a very sort of, I don't want to say non-social place, but it is unlike any workplace I have ever visited. It is the quietest workplace I have ever been in. It's deceptive. You look around and it's sort of, you know, books and papers and cubicles, and it looks like any normal workplace, but it is dead silent. Most of the staff doesn't even bother having a phone on their desk. I mean, sure, everyone's got their cell phone, but it's in their pocket or turned off. Nobody's talking. There's very little talking. And in fact, into the 1990s, it was a de facto rule at the company that you did not talk on the second floor. So the way people would communicate, whether it was to see if you wanted to go out and grab a sandwich for lunch or to ask a question about a particular word, was to write on one of these little citation slips, drop it in a bin, and then you would go check your bin. And if there was a slip of paper in there, you would read it and you would write a reply and put it in your colleague's bin. Hmm. So rather than just walk over to someone's desk and say, are you ready to go grab lunch now? You would go through this elaborate process of quiet.
Makes you wonder about office romance and how that was carried out before the 1990s.
Probably on slips. I mean, the director of defining, Steve Perot, and the director of editorial operations at Merriam are married, Madeline Novak. They got married 5 years after they started working there in 1979 and 1980, respectively. I mean, this is a place that also fosters tremendous loyalty and a lot of lifers. I think people fall into the world of lexicography and fall in love with it and stay there.
Stefan Fatsis is my guest. You know him as a commentator for All Things Considered. He's also a frequent contributor to Slate, where his article, The Definition of a Dictionary, is online now. We'll resume this conversation in a few minutes. You can join it by calling 1-800-933-5372. You can send me a tweet at Chris Boyd Think or email think at kera.org.
Funding for Think comes from SMU Continuing and Professional Education, offering the SMU Certificate Program, where you can learn to draw and paint, how to speak French, or plan for your retirement. Courses start each week through spring. Registration and information is at smu.edu/CPFP.
You're listening to Think on KERA 90.1. I'm Chris Boyd. We're speaking this hour with Stefan Fatsis, who is a commentator for All Things Considered and a contributor to Slate, where his article, The Definition of a Dictionary, is available online now. You can join this conversation at 1-800-933-5372 or email think at kera.org. Okay, Stefan, let's get a little history here. Who bought unabridged dictionaries in the 19th and early 20th centuries, and how did they use them?
Unabridged dictionaries were these aspirational tools. They were symbols of status. They were symbols of acculturation. They were symbols of an educated home. So people that bought them were educated classes. They were expensive. When the Merriams took over the company in the 1840s from Noah Webster, the founder, they actually cut the price of their dictionaries, but they were still considered expensive. So the Merriams tried to democratize the dictionary, but it was still perceived as a status symbol. So you wanted one in your home to indicate that you were erudite, that you were educated, that you were learning, that you wanted to learn. Immigrants had dictionaries. Anyone had dictionaries who wanted to show that they were striving. They were sort of important. They were important sort of decorations for your living room that were in the best circumstances used, and in other circumstances, they're more just to show that you were cultured. My father emigrated from overseas, and I found when we were clearing out our house, I found a 1949 Merriam-Webster's fifth edition of the Collegiate Dictionary with his signature in it. He must have bought it the first year he came to America.
What a treasure to have.
It is. It's this wonderful leather-bound volume. It's beautiful.
So Merriam-Webster's last comprehensive overhaul was in 1961 under the direction of this delightfully iconoclastic editor named Philip B. Gove. First of all, how did he get the job of supervising those revisions?
Well, he was not a Merriam lifer, unlike many people even at the time. And he had worked overseas during World War II. He was an academic. And then he came to Merriam after the war and sort of worked his way up. And they cycled through several sort of tryouts of editors. And then before the third edition, the editorship of Merriam-Webster's Unabridged Dictionary was considered a job for a famous person, a noted academic, someone from Yale or Harvard, typically. So Gove was a departure from this in that he was much more of a lexicographer. He was brought in as an editor, and sort of they settled on him as a logical choice when Merriam's leaders basically decided that we don't need a figurehead. We want a hardcore lexicographer to run this project.
I was reading about him, and we'll talk about the changes that he made and why he was so controversial, but I was thinking he was like the Pope Francis of the dictionary world, right? He was brought in, and people maybe thought they knew what they were getting, and then he turned around and did exactly what he thought was the right thing to do.
Right. And I think a lot of people, there was a tremendous amount of continuity at Merriam-Webster, and that was something that was prized. This was a very buttoned-down, sober place with people who had tremendous academic credentials. They relied on outside consultants also who had academic credentials. When you open up Webster's third, the 1961 book, There are several pages listing all of the contributors, the outside consultants, and they're experts in basically name a field, Maori etymology and pavement construction and colors. I mean, you go on and on. It's really funny to read, but at the same time, you sort of understood the sobriety and the seriousness with which you had to approach creating a dictionary before the internet. So Gove was brought in, and the idea was, you know, probably they thought there'll be continuity with the second edition of Merriam's, which was published, of the Unabridged, which was published in 1934. And that book was heralded at the time because it was very prescriptive. It told you what was right and it told you what was wrong. It contained hundreds and hundreds of pages of encyclopedic information, you know, lists of popes and presidents and dukes and name places and characters from Shakespeare and Chaucer. But it wasn't terribly democratic. There was very little in there about popular culture. And it was very, you know, when I say prescriptive, I mean very specifically, it prescribed how you should use words, whether it was appropriate or inappropriate. And the labels were very, very precise: illiterate, inappropriate. Gove came from the new field of linguistics, of structural linguistics. And his belief was that the dictionary should be more reflective of the way people actually use language, that our conventions about what was right and wrong in speech and usage were outmoded, and that the dictionary should reflect these changes in language, and also that it needed to lighten up a little bit, that it needed to recognize baseball players and Hollywood movie stars, that they were part of culture as well, so that when you were using quotations to illustrate a definition of a word, it didn't always have to come from some dead white male. It could actually come from Ethel Merman or from, you know, from Babe Ruth or from anybody, a modern writer or singer or performer or a popular culture figure. So Gove set out to change the content of the dictionary. He also set out to change the style of the dictionary, and that was also pretty radical.
He changed the style in part because he obviously he worked with format, but he also looked at the most common uses of words. Is that right?
He did. I mean, format was really important with Gove because they didn't want to publish another. The second edition of Merriam's Dictionary sort of pushed the boundaries of what you could physically publish. It weighed like 19 pounds. You really couldn't actually bind in one volume any more pages than Webster Second did. I mean, Webster Second was considered the idea was that it would be everything to everybody, that you could look up anything in this book and find it out. One of Steve Perot, the director of Defining at Merriam, describes it as the internet of its time. It was intended to answer any question you had. Gove had a different philosophy. He wanted to get more words in there. And he also wanted to keep the thing manageable. And it's still like 2,700 pages and weighs 13 pounds at publication in 1961. But he axed hundreds and hundreds of pages of this biographical stuff. He cut out tens of thousands of words so that he could introduce more modern words, words that had come into vogue since World War II that really encapsulated the breadth of the language and weren't quite so narrow and sort of snooty. A lot of scientific words were cut out. A lot of words that you really didn't need to have in a dictionary that was bound between, you know, two covers.
Was he the first one to be willing to define profane language?
He was not the first one. There was one profanity that was that the president of Merriam refused to allow him to include in the book. But I think he understood that words are words and that part of a dictionary's job is to reflect all usages. And for the heat that got Gove, that what got Gove into trouble, and this created a bigger controversy than you can ever imagine. I mean, something that captivated the nation. I mean, every major publication was writing about Webster's Third in 1961. And the reason wasn't that it was received as this wonderful book. The reason was that it was criticized as being too permissive, that it got rid of a lot of these labels and sort of went only with a couple, non-standard, for instance. Gove didn't believe that we needed to artificially restrict or instruct. He wanted language reflected again. And the critics seized on that, that it was permissive, that our culture and our language were going into the toilet, that this was a calamity for American culture that reflected a decline in our society. The New York Times editorialized about this book multiple times. There were scathing, long magazine pieces in The Atlantic and The New Yorker, and also sort of editorials and columns poking fun at Merriam-Webster for taking such a permissive approach to language and including a lot of what we consider slang. The truth was that Webster II included a lot of these words, but the way that Gove chose to label them was the cause of part of the problem. And also just one bad press release at the outset that sort of touted the inclusion of ain't in the dictionary. And ain't was included and not sort of stricken as illiterate or improper. It was just in there as non-standard. It was also in Webster II. So a lot of this was a giant tempest created by some sort of bad PR and some bad crisis management at Merriam-Webster.
So Gove stripped out all of this encyclopedic information that he figured people could get elsewhere or didn't necessarily need. But then some of his definitions were just like incredibly long. Do you have in front of you the definition that was included in the 1961 Merriam-Webster's for hotel?
I do.
Okay, will you read it?
I would be glad to. I have to take a deep breath. Yeah. And I will preface this by saying one of the major lexicographic changes that Gove implemented was that each definition had to be a single unit. No periods and commas only to separate items in a series. The idea was you wanted to cram as much information as you could in there, but it created this incredibly stilted sense of what a definition is in art. So hotel, ready? Mm-hmm. A building of many rooms, chiefly for overnight accommodation of transients and several floors served by elevators, usually with a large open street level lobby containing easy chairs with a variety of compartments for eating, drinking, dancing, exhibitions, and group meetings. As of salesman or convention attendance, with shops having both inside and street side entrances and offering for sale items as clothes, gifts, candy, theater tickets, travel tickets of particular interest to a traveler, or providing personal services as hairdressing, shoe shining, and with telephone booths, writing tables, and washrooms freely available.
Well, there's nothing he left out.
That's a hotel, people.
I guess the idea was you wanted to make sure that the definition was complete. It would seem that sometimes the most common words really are harder to define than ones that people don't use as often.
Yeah, and that was the idea. The idea was that it's unabridged. We need to be as precise and complete as possible. And we have eliminated tens of thousands of other words so that we can have this freedom to go longer and be thorough. It sounds ridiculous to us today because the way we process language, the way we read and write is far less formal. So a definition like hotel seems ridiculous. But at the time, it was this, you know, it embodied Gove's style of being as thorough and precise as possible. So on the one hand, Gove wanted to be liberal in what he included in the dictionary and the way he described the words and the usage of the words. On the other hand, he insisted on this rigid formulation, this rigid structure that was designed to be simple for the reader in some ways because each definition was consistent in style, but at the same time created these sort of ridiculous situations like hotel or door or oxygen, which were other definitions that are also equally ludicrous.
Stefan Fatsis is here. He is author of an article on Slate right now called The Definition of a Dictionary. You may also know him as a commentator for All Things Considered. We'll resume our conversation in a few minutes. You can join it by calling 1-800-933-5372. Thanks so much. We'll be back in 2 minutes with Stefan Fatsis.
Funding for Think comes from SMU Continuing and Professional Education, offering the SMU Certificate Program where you can learn to draw and paint, how to speak French, or plan for your retirement. Courses start each week through spring. Registration and information is at smu.edu/cpfp.
You're listening to Think on KERA 90.1. I'm Chris Boyd. We're speaking this hour to journalist Stefan Fatsis about his article, The Definition of a Dictionary, which is online now at Slate. You can join us at 1-800-933-5372 or send me a tweet at Chris Boyd Think. Stefan, the beauty of the online format, as you mentioned earlier, is that there are essentially no space constraints. You can be as verbose as you need to be in order to get the definition complete. On the other hand, you want to keep people's interest and you want to make sure that things are clear. What did you learn about the way writers of definitions try to make their copy really sing?
What I learned was that there is still a tremendous emphasis placed on concision, on conciseness, on making sure that you are clear. So the liberating part of online, and this was the reaction throughout Merriam-Webster when it was announced that they were going to redo the unabridged dictionary exclusively online, was that, oh my God, for the first time in the history of lexicography, I don't have to worry about every comma, about having something fit onto a page. And the way dictionaries were updated in the past was literally, it was trying to squeeze as much as many words onto the page as possible. And that often involved, you know, cutting out the lines, the words, definitions, senses of particular words. And so there's the tremendous sense of liberation. But on the other hand, there's the example of door. You can't bore your reader either. So in some senses, what I like to think of what these lexicographers are doing is they're writing these little biographies of words. They still need to be captivating to the audience, but they also need to be, first and foremost, they need to be clear and they need to be concise and they need to be accurate. But this next step, now that the online part is added, is that they can be more expansive in other ways. There can be etymological notes about the history and the evolution of a word. There can be usage notes that explain in greater depth how a word is used and how the usage of a word has changed over time. So there's still this idea of finding a balance, at least at places like Merriam. It's not just we have the bottomless pit of the internet, let's write as much as we can and include 50 example quotations for every word. There's still a sense of getting it right and ensuring the very first thing is to ensure that a word deserves to be included. Just because we can put anything online, Merriam still believes that there are standards in terms of what words should be included in their dictionaries.
Are there hard and fast rules specifically for neologisms? Like how much traction does a word have to have before it's included?
It's incredibly subjective, as you might guess that it would be. I mean, there are no rules that say, you know, a word passes a certain threshold and a bell goes off and now it can be included in Merriam's dictionary. It's not like confetti falls from the ceiling in Springfield, Massachusetts, when, you know, when torque reached a certain threshold. It's really very subjective. And a lot of it is based now on far more evidence than editors had in previous generations, where they were relying on printed matter and they were relying on what got read. It was still a remarkably accurate system. Words that got admitted to the unabridged or to other dictionaries tended to have tremendous penetration in the culture. And Merriam was very deliberate about how long it would allow words to sit for the evidence to accumulate in those citation files we talked about before an editor decided, okay, it's worthy of entry now. Now, obviously, there are corpuses and databases that editors rely on and can much more quickly assess how much a word is used and make that kind of a decision. So what I think is happening at Merriam is that the sort of the waiting period for words is getting shorter because the editors can go to Google Books or go to Nexus and collect 10 or 20 or 100 citations for a word and see it in action in living and breathing in culture. At the same time, there's a standard. So while it can happen more quickly, the editors still want to see that level of penetration to justify the inclusion of a word.
Do pronunciations change over time?
Oh, sure. Everything changes over time. Usage changes over time. Pronunciation changes over time. Merriam has a pronouncer who sits in a little room on the editorial floor working on pronunciations, and he's an expert in linguistics and pronunciation. So everything is in flux. And that's the remarkable thing. And the thing that I think people tend to forget about language is that, you know, we expect the dictionary, you know, capital T, capital D, to be this one object that we can turn to for some sort of declarative, definitive explanation about a word. But the reality is that words are changing every day because of how we're using them. And what we consider to be words is changing every day. And this is the dilemma that Merriam and other traditional dictionary publishers face, is how do we acknowledge that change? How do we not relax our standards, but at the same time recognize the speed with which our culture tends to cycle through and process and adopt new words?
1-800-933-5372 is our number. We have an email here from Kelly in Dallas who says, as a child of immigrants myself, I'm intrigued by the story of your immigrant father and his dictionary. I presume his native language was not English. From where did he immigrate and what role do you think the dictionary played in his acculturation?
He emigrated from Greece, but he spent many years at sea as a ship's captain on cargo ships. So he spoke many languages. His English was pretty good, but you know, moving to the United States, he married an American-born Greek woman, my mother. He had three American children. You know, his English wasn't great, but I imagine in those early years, the dictionary was important to him and that it was something that he kept on his desk at work to communicate with the people that he had to work with in this country and deal with on a daily basis.
I love dictionaries and I like to look up words. I probably do it daily, but I don't often use a hard copy anymore. And one of the things I miss is accidentally allowing my eyes to fall on a word that I didn't intend to look up.
Yeah, and that is one of the things you lose. And what I also found in interviewing and spending time with Merriam-Webster's editors is that the nostalgia for print books is just that. It's nostalgia. The internet works much better for this. We have access to so much information, and you know there are word sites that are more liberal than certainly Merriam, which still has that rigid single statement definition style, like Wordnik, which was started by a lexicographer named Aaron McKean, and it pulls in words from many databases and creates a sort of immediate portrait of a word on the page in front of you with, you know, from citations from Twitter or from, you know, Merriam-Webster's, you know, probably not from Merriam-Webster because it's not licensed to them, but from other standard dictionaries, from Google Books and other corpuses. So the ability to do that is wide ranging. But yes, that experience, that sort of digressive print experience is gone if you're not using a print book. On the other hand, someone is probably going to design something that works that way. And I think that's what gives lexicographers like Merriam-Webster, that makes them excited about the future of dictionaries, because we don't know what the next app or the next website is going to look like. And if people want that kind of an experience, someone's going to design it. And if people are willing to pay for it, someone is going to find a way to create that, to sort of mimic the print experience that we have and love. But John Morris, the president of Merriam, said to me, you know, I don't really miss the books that much because what we have online does this job better, that dictionaries are databases and they are meant to be used this way in our modern life.
So you made a small contribution to Merriam-Webster's next edition of the dictionary. Tell us about that.
Well, the one I recited that I mentioned in the piece is I made actually two. And there's one, so this is sort of breaking news here, Chris. The one I did in the piece, I was sitting with a lexicographer named Emily Brewster, and I kind of made a suggestion. She was working on a word, and I wanted to watch how she sort of prepared a definition. She was working on new words, and that's like the dream job, she described it, of lexicography, because you get to define stuff that hasn't been defined before. And she was working on a word, upcycle, which has a verb meaning and a noun meaning. And she was working at the time on the noun meaning of upcycle, which is a period of increased activity in the economy or in other fields. And I just kind of casually suggested, I was looking at the citations she was collecting from newspaper stories going back into the 1980s. And I made a quick suggestion like, oh, well, they all seem to be from Wall Street. Why don't you know, how about this? And she was like, oh, that's pretty good. Can I use that? and in the end, she unfortunately did not use it. But however, if you subscribe to Merriam-Webster's Unabridged and you go look up the word Meyer Lemon and you listen to the definition, That's my voice. I'm the voice of I'm the voice of Meyer Lemon. So I got to read a pronunciation. I was pretty excited about that.
Fantastic. Make sure that gets on your resume.
She'll get me hired somewhere, right? In radio, maybe.
Exactly. Journalist and author Stefan Fatsis is a commentator for All Things Considered and a frequent contributor to Slate, where his article, The Definition of a Dictionary, is online now. Stefan, it's been such a pleasure. Thank you so much for making time for us.
No, Chris, thank you so much for having me. That was fun.